Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, who examines the history of the Egyptian military, now in control of a process that they claim will lead to a transition from autocracy to democracy. Claire Texier of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who explains the basis for an international effort to hold former U.S. President George W. Bush accountable for his authorization of torture against U.S.-held detainees. And Andrew Miller, advocacy coordinator with the group Amazon Watch, who discusses an Ecuadorian court decision finding oil giant Chevron guilty of polluting the Amazon rainforest. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Concern about popular uprisings seen in Tunisia, Egypt, and across the Middle East may be instilling fear in the autocratic regimes in the states of the former Soviet Union and Central Asia. Kazakhstan's longtime president Nazarbayev canceled plans for a referendum to extend his rule for another decade. Instead, he called a snap presidential election, which surprised the nation's weak opposition parties. In Uzbekistan, President Islam Karimov, who had strong ties to the old Soviet regime, is seeking new credibility with the European Union despite a miserable human rights record that includes the use of child labor. For now, the EU and NATO are seeking better ties with President Karimov to maintain supply lines for the war in Afghanistan. For most leaders in these authoritarian regimes, civil society is weak, and the bigger threat comes from radical Islam and insurgents trained in Afghanistan. But the fear of radical Islam is often exaggerated in order to blunt strong criticism of deep poverty and massive corruption, noted Central Asia observer Eric McGinchy of George Mason University. In oil-rich Azerbaijan, power has become a family affair where President Aliyev inherited the post from his father, and the leader is also planning to hand over power to his son someday. On the day of last November's presidential election, less than a quarter of Haitians came out to vote, and several political parties were barred from the contest, including those loyal to twice-ousted President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who remains in exile in South Africa. The power vacuum attracted former Haitian dictator Jean-Claude Duvalier to return to Haiti. Aristide is also now determined to return to Haiti. According to The Nation magazine, the big surprise in November's first round election was the emergence of right-wing musician Michel Martelly, who beat incumbent President René Préval's hand-picked successor, Jude Celestine. Martelly will run against former First Lady Mirlande Manigat in a runoff election scheduled for March 20th. Haiti currently suffers from a government that is incapable of charting an independent course, dependent on large international donors and peacekeeping forces from the United Nations. The impoverished nation also has a difficult time saying no to the power-seeking business elite that shows little concern for the misery suffered by the Haitian masses. In March 2009, civil society protesters forced out Madagascar President Marc Ravalomanana, fueled by anger at his lease of cropland in the poor African nation to a wealthy multinational corporation. The former Madagascar president agreed to lease 3.2 million acres, half of the island nation's arable land, to South Korean conglomerate Daewoo for the sum of $6 billion. The corporation planned to use the land to grow corn and palm oil. Protests backed by the military forced out the president and scuttled the deal with Daewoo, according to the Christian Science Monitor. Similar deals are going forward across Africa, and investors include governments and state-run enterprises from Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Brazil, and India, seeking long-term food security. Meanwhile, agriculture in sub-Saharan Africa is hampered by lack of investment where food staples like corn, rice, and wheat are imported from wealthy countries. The growing number of land deals in Africa spurred debate among activists at the recent World Social Forum meeting in Dakar, Senegal. Mercia Andrews of the South African group Trust for Community Outreach and Education told the Interpress Service there is a massive land grab taking place, and Western countries are coming to Africa and using African land to feed themselves at the expense of Africans. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
After 18 days of determined anti-regime protest across Egypt, it was the nation's military that played a decisive role in forcing President Mubarak to relinquish his 30-year hold on power when his resignation was announced on February 11th. Although the leaders of Egypt's popular uprising expressed faith in the military to support the people over the Mubarak government, it was this same army which served as a linchpin in propping up the one-party state for three decades. Not long after Mubarak fled Cairo for his family estate in Sharm el-Sheikh, the military announced the suspension of the Egyptian constitution and the dissolution of parliament, widely viewed as a rubber stamp for the regime. The army pledged to organize democratic elections within 6 months and turn over power to a civilian government. But little is known about the 18-member Supreme Council of the Armed Forces that now controls Egypt, headed by 76-year-old Field Marshal Mohammed Hussein Tantawi. A U.S. diplomatic cable published by WikiLeaks cited academics and civilian analysts who described Tantawi as Mubarak's poodle and incompetent. After Mubarak's ouster, thousands of public employees have organized protests and strikes, demanding higher wages and improved working conditions. The military quickly responded by calling on labor leaders to halt all job actions and allow a sense of normalcy to return to the country. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. She examines the role of the Egyptian military, now in control of a process that they claim will lead to a transition from autocracy to democracy.
Even now, even with the military having declared that they are in control, that they are ruling under martial law, not civil law, it still is the people of Egypt who have the upper hand in many ways. The military, it's a very large military in Egypt, and it's quite divided between the highest ranking brass whose fortunes were made and strengthened through their ties to the Mubarak regime, and the majority of the members of the military itself who do not have all those same interests. There's an extraordinary story circulating, and it may well be apocryphal, I don't know, and that is that at the time that Mubarak ordered the military, not just his secret police, but the military, to crush the protests in Tahrir Square, to use tanks in particular, the tank drivers, an elite military unit, many of whom come from long-standing military families where several generations back the men have gone into the military. They were uneasy about this notion that they should be using their enormous, of course, U.S.-provided tanks against unarmed civilians in Tahrir Square, against fellow Egyptians. And many of them phoned home and spoke to their parents, and their fathers in particular, who had been in the military, told them, don't do it. Don't fire on the people. And they didn't. Now, whether that's all true or how many it was true for, I don't know. But what is true, what's unequivocally true, is they didn't fire. And it's clear now that there were orders given that were rejected. So I think that there is a sense that the military has an interest now at a moment of transition, a moment of potential chaos. There is certainly an interest by the military in maintaining popular support. They don't want people to turn against them. So they have every interest of winning over mass support. Now, having said that, I think any time you have a democratic revolution, a democratic momentum that is dependent on the goodwill of the military, you're already in trouble. That's a dangerous moment, and that's the moment that the Egyptian people find themselves in right now. So this is not by any means a done deal. This is not a settled revolution. This is a revolution that has won a huge victory regardless of anything else that happens. What we have to look ahead to is what's it going to take to consolidate that victory rather than seeing a victory that is fleeting and that disappears later.
Egypt's Armed Forces Commander Mohamed Hussein Tantawi, I would imagine, having been head of the armed forces for many years, he was close to Mubarak. What do we know about Tantawi and where he might lead Egypt, given all the power he now holds?
We don't know a huge amount about Tantawi, and the irony is we probably have access to more information about him here than most people in Egypt do. He wasn't a major public figure in Egypt in recent years. He is understood to be one of the closest allies of Mubarak, and that, of course, is very dangerous because it speaks to a systemic interest in stability of the old regime, of the old guard. Tantawi is known to be the closest of Egypt's top-ranking officials to the Pentagon. He was, in fact, at the Pentagon when the protests began on January 25th and had to fly home quickly to deal with the situation. He has very close ties in terms of training, funding, equipment, all those things that the U.S. so nicely provides to military dictatorships all around the world. Although the military obviously played an important role globally in protecting the regime, the day-to-day work of dictatorship, the arrests, the torture, the interrogation, was primarily not carried out by the military, but by the almost equally as large secret police agencies, who were the target of far more rage and antagonism and anger by the Egyptian people than was the military itself.
Phyllis, I wonder if you would give us your take on the United States and its future foreign policy towards Egypt and in the Middle East as a whole, following not only the revolution in Egypt and Tunisia, but the sparks of a larger fire all over the region. President Obama famously in 2009 made a speech in Cairo calling for democracy and human rights, but then his administration really did absolutely nothing tangible to promote those values. Do you think going forward, the United States under Obama or the permanent establishment is going to look at the world any differently?
I think they already are. I'm not sure all of them like what they see. I think a few do, but I think there's no question that there are vast divergences within the administration. What they're not, I think, taking seriously on any side is the understanding of just how much they risk of their own traditional definition of U.S. positioning in the region if they don't completely reverse their longstanding position of funding dictatorships, providing a military policy that's based on oil, Israel, and U.S.-grounded stability. Without that, what they face is that any new government that comes to power in Egypt, whatever combination of forces are involved, whether it's the young internet activists, whether it's parts of the Muslim Brotherhood, whether it's some of the civil society traditional opposition parties, whether it's al-Baradei's party or some combination of all of them, whoever comes to power is going to be insisting that Egypt be taken seriously in a whole different way than it ever was under the U.S. for the past 30 years. And if they don't change their position, if they continue to fund only the military, if they continue to maintain this position that the U.S. has a right to determine the future of Egypt, they risk an entire generation of antagonism from the people of Egypt towards the government and, unfortunately, probably the people of the United States.
That was Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. She is author of Challenging Empire, How People, Governments, and the UN Defy U.S. Power. Read her articles online at ips-dc.org. Although George W. Bush has been out of office since January 2009, human rights groups in America and around the world are working to hold the former U.S. president accountable for what many international law scholars believe to be human rights abuses and war crimes. Two torture victims had planned to file criminal complaints in Geneva, Switzerland, on behalf of the U.S.-based Center for Constitutional Rights and the Berlin-based European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights on February 7th, naming President Bush as responsible for authorizing their torture, including waterboarding, while in U.S. custody. The filing of the complaints was to coincide with Mr. Bush's scheduled trip to Switzerland on February 12th, as Swiss law requires that a person being charged with torture must be present in the country before an investigation can be opened. However, at the last moment, the former president canceled his trip to Switzerland, presumably due to the legal case being filed against him. Although Mr. Bush's canceled trip to Switzerland derailed the planned preliminary indictment, the human rights groups involved in preparing the complaints announced that their 42-page legal document, including 2,500 pages of supporting material, could be used against President Bush in his future travels abroad. Under terms of the UN Convention Against Torture, all signatories of the treaty, including the U.S., are obligated to prosecute anyone present in their territory if there is evidence supporting allegations that an individual has committed torture. President Bush has proudly admitted in press interviews that he authorized waterboarding of U.S.-held terrorist suspects. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Claire Texier, a jurist and legal researcher with the Center for Constitutional Rights. She explains the basis for the Bush torture indictment and plans by human rights groups to pursue the case around the world.
The evidence that we have is actually quite impressive. It's a very straightforward and easy case. There has been hundreds of pages of declassified reports that have shed light on how George W. Bush authorized the CIA secret detention program, on how he shaped those policies, on how he authorized personally and condoned and so-called enhanced interrogation techniques. We have testimonies, we have international reports, but most importantly, in Bush's case, we have his own acknowledgement that he authorized torture. He has said in his memoirs that were released last November that he personally, when he was asked by the CIA if he would authorize them to proceed to waterboarding of a detainee, he writes in his book that he replied, "Damn right, I do." And that detainee was subsequently waterboarded 183 times in 1 month. And then other detainees were subjected to waterboarding. And ultimately, that also paved the way, obviously, for even more abuses. Waterboarding is torture. There is not a doubt that it is torture. Today, even the Obama administration fully recognizes that waterboarding is torture. So you have the former president of the United States saying, yes, I did authorize torture. He also said it on TV on primetime during his interview back in November. And, you know, we have a lot of other documents establishing his personal criminal responsibility. You know, exactly 9 years ago, on February 7, 2002, George Bush signed a memo in which he decided that the Geneva Conventions did not apply to the Taliban or Al-Qaeda detainees, and including the clause that prohibits inhuman treatment and acts of torture. And that the Senate itself, in a bipartisan committee report, has found that that memo did pave the way for the abuses of detainees in the war on terror. But now, as the evidence keeps on coming out, it's even worse than that. I mean, he personally authorized and condoned waterboarding and other acts of torture. So it's a pretty straightforward case, unfortunately.
What has been the reaction of the Obama administration since they took office in 2009 in terms of complaints about human rights abuses by U.S. officials, including George W. Bush and former Defense Secretary Rumsfeld, as well as some of the attorneys that were advising the White House, like John Yoo. What has been the Obama administration's reaction to calls for investigations and prosecution?
The Obama administration, since 2009, has repeatedly said, with regards to prosecution of these crimes perpetrated by American officials, we want to look forward. We do not want to look backwards. And they have decided not to initiate any serious investigation into the criminal responsibility of higher-ups. There's been one special prosecutor appointed to look at a very, very narrow group of possible abuses perpetrated basically bad apples, you know, officials on the ground. That mandate of the investigation is so narrow that never would it go up the chain of command and never would it go looking at the actual torture program. That is unbelievable. And more than that, the WikiLeaks revelations last December have revealed something really even more confusing and more than disappointing. It revealed that the embassy of the United States in Madrid did all it could in 2009, under the Obama presidency, to block the two pending proceedings in Spain that were looking at the responsibility of Bush administration officials for authorizing torture at Guantanamo and elsewhere. So it's one thing to not start investigation in your own country. It's another to even block efforts in other countries, and that's actually directly hurting the independence of justice in that country, which is yet another crime in itself.
What are the next steps for these international human rights groups when it comes to holding Bush administration officials accountable?
Well, the document that we have publicly released that we call the Indictment for Torture for Bush is a living document that we're going to be updating and strengthening, and we're going to be looking at where Bush is traveling next. He's scheduled to go to Canada next October, so we're going to be working with Canadian groups and seeing what can be done over there. But we're also looking, obviously, at the other Bush administration officials like Cheney, like Rumsfeld, or Tenet, and as well as the administration's lawyers, John Yoo or Addington or Jay Bybee, and we have dossiers ready for them, and we will pursue accountability wherever and whenever we can.
That was Claire Texier, jurist and legal researcher with the Center for Constitutional Rights. Learn more about the case against former President Bush by visiting the group's website at ccrjustice.org. On February 14th, a judge in the Ecuadorian town of Lago Agrio ruled that U.S.-based oil giant Chevron was guilty of polluting an area of the Amazon rainforest the size of Rhode Island and must pay $8.6 billion in damages, including 10% of the total, to an organization formed to represent the plaintiffs, comprised of indigenous farmers and other residents of the area. Chevron reacted by declaring that the verdict was fraudulent, quote, illegitimate and unenforceable, and is appealing the case. The plaintiffs are also appealing, maintaining that remediation will cost much more than the $9 billion awarded by the court. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Andrew Miller, the Washington, D.C. advocacy coordinator with Amazon Watch, a San Francisco-based organization that works with indigenous groups in the Amazon to defend their rights, often against U.S.-based multinational companies. Miller explains that the litigation has already gone on for 18 years, and that this court ruling will likely not be the end of the case, but nevertheless is still a significant milestone in the pursuit of justice and compensation.
Chevron is guilty in the eyes of the Ecuadorian court system of essentially environmental crimes, of destroying huge swaths of the Ecuadorian Amazon, of polluting water, of causing damages to tens of thousands of people on the ground. It's really only one step in a long multi-decade process. The court trial started almost 2 decades ago, 18 years ago, and we anticipate it will go on for probably a number of more years. But it is an important step, and it's especially crucial for people on the ground who've been making these accusations against Chevron for many years. And of course, Chevron has been, you know, essentially saying that it's false and that these people are lying and that this is just a big shakedown. I think the broader implication is one for questions of corporate accountability, questions of environmental justice and human rights. And our hope is that, one, this gives the space for communities to hold big companies accountable, and two, hopefully it also leads to a change in corporate culture, to more of a preventative kind of a corporate culture where costs are taken on the front end in order to avoid having multi-billion dollar lawsuits down the road.
How much of the evidence related to human health costs? Did people die? Were a lot of people sickened? And that was part of what was presented in court?
Part of the evidence has to do with, you know, the fact that people are consuming water and have been consuming water and bathing in it and preparing their food in it and eating fish that swim in it for decades now. And we've seen the rise of any number of different kinds of skin diseases and cancers, which never existed previously. So there are, you know, different estimates of the number of people who have died from essentially oil-related diseases. One of the numbers is around 1,400 people. So that was some of the information that was presented. A lot of the evidence were soil samples, were tens of thousands of soil samples that were done in the different sites, the different drilling sites, the different sites where toxic waste were dumped.
What's the square mileage of the area that's been despoiled?
It's an area that's about the size of Rhode Island. It's also worth mentioning that this is a particularly biodiverse part of the world. The area where the Andes come down and hit the Amazon, it's a biodiversity hotspot. This site is also part of the headwaters of the Amazon River, and pollution that is created in this area flows downriver and unfortunately is added to other pollution from other oil drilling sites in northern Peru, for example. There have been a number of recent oil pipelines breaking and spilling into the rivers. And then you have different kinds of mining that's going on. So all of these toxic elements are actually being added into the Amazon River and flow down river. And so all the millions of people that depend on these waters are being exposed directly or indirectly to these contaminations.
Andrew Miller, I know that Chevron is going to appeal, but I've heard that the plaintiffs are also appealing, saying the ruling isn't nearly enough. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. We're likely to see appeals on both sides. There are a number of estimates that had come out previously. There was a court-appointed expert who had set the damages to the $27 billion. And there were other international experts who came, saw the situation, and actually placed the estimated damages at tens of billions of dollars. Now, essentially what we're talking about and the primary demand of the communities is a real remediation of the soil, a remediation of the water sources and water that they can drink, and health care. The settlement, we're not talking about communities that are going to get big cash infusions and each individual community member is going to get millions of dollars as part of this. What we're really talking about is how to remediate the situation, which is very fragile and is going to be very difficult, and how to ensure that these communities have access to fresh water and to health care to address the health issues they've been facing.
That was Andrew Miller, advocacy coordinator with Amazon Watch. Contact the group's San Francisco office at area code 415-487-9600 or visit their website at amazonwatch.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut, 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.